Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.
Man, I've just suddenly got feeling very sorry for Justine Toe, who has to go on after that. We'd like at least four voices from you, please, Justine. Justine is Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity, and her professional background is as a journalist, where she worked at Reuters Australia and Fairfax Digital Media before completing her doctorate in cultural studies at Sydney's Macquarie University. Justine really is a much sought-after public speaker and a prolific writer with a special interest in Christianity and everyday life. In a recent article, Justine said this: "Our culture of the big me primes us to ask what we want from life. Vocation or a sense of calling quiets the self since it flips the question. What is life asking of me? How can I match my intrinsic talent with one of the world's deep needs?" I think we're going to look forward to listening to Justine. Please welcome her to the stage in this conference. Thank you.
So yeah, I didn't quite write that. It was more David Brooks. Is anyone familiar with David Brooks's work? He's a New York Times columnist. We will be looking at a little bit of it today. Okay, so now I hesitate to recommend this essay because it's pretty hard going in terms of its, I guess, sexual content, but Emily Witt went to San Francisco and she documented the seedy sexual underbelly of that city. And she explored how this seedy underbelly, what that underbelly had in common with the shiny tech conglomerates of Silicon Valley. And there was, what they shared in common was this sense of freedom and choice. But in the midst of this essay, she writes, "I had made no conscious decision to be single, but love is rare and it is frequently unreciprocated. Because of this, people around me continued to view love as a sort of messianic event, and my friends expressed a religious belief that it would arrive for me one day, as if love was something the universe owed to each of us, which no human could escape. I had known love, but having known love, I knew how powerless I was to instigate it or ensure its duration. Whether love was going to arrive or not, I couldn't suspend my life in the expectation of its arrival. So back in New York, I was single, but only very rarely would more than a few weeks pass without some kind of sexual encounter. We were souls flitting through limbo, piling up against one another like dried leaves, circling around, awaiting the Messiah." So romantic love is Emily Witt's Messiah. And I think it's very revealing that even if religion is seen as something quite passé today, people still look to something like religion, like romantic love as their new religion, to complete them, to save them, to fulfil them. So even in a post-Christian age, secular people still worship. Now, if you're familiar with the Augustinian anthropology of the human that James K. Smith spells out in Desiring the Kingdom, this would come as no surprise to you. Believers or skeptics, religious, irreligious, a-religious, we all alike are engaged in worship of some kind or another. And Smith, following Augustine, says that we humans are ultimately lovers. We're desiring creatures whose love is shaped by what we love or what we love as ultimate, what, at the end of the day, gives us a sense of meaning and purpose. So to say that we're fundamentally desiring creatures means that it's not a question of whether we love, but what we love. Smith says, it's like we have a love pump at the core of our being and it can't be switched off. And it's aimed at God or a rival God, what I'm calling today in this talk, a lesser God. Now, the lesser gods that we devote ourselves to are visions of the good life, conceptions of human flourishing that captivate us and draw us toward them. Smith puts it this way: every one of us is on a kind of Arthurian quest for the Holy Grail, that hoped for, longed for, dreamed for picture of the good life, the realm of human flourishing that we pursue without end. Now, this holy grail, this picture of the good life, is so attractive that we can't help but be drawn after it. It shapes our decisions, what we do in our lives every day. And you might even say that we wind up creating ourselves in the image of the good life that we pursue. But of course, it remains to be seen whether we actually like what we find. Now, Witt's holy grail, her messiah, is romantic love. But as Ross Douthat notes, there's no shortage of other lesser gods that demand our worship. He says, at the deepest level, every human culture is religious, defined by what its habitants believe about some ultimate reality and what they think that reality demands of them. It doesn't have to be a personal god. It can be Marxism. It can be the religion of blood and soil, Gaia, the church of the free market, the cult of the imperial self. But Bob Dylan had it right. You've got to serve somebody, and everybody does. Well, every culture does. But not just every culture, every human as well. Now, this means that we've got to be really attentive to the ways in which we're drawn towards particular visions of the good life. You know, how is it that we come to pursue our holy grails, whatever they are? Now, Smith says it happens through education, right? We tend to think of education as informative, as passing on knowledge, but he says that education is more formative. It actually makes us into particular kinds of people. Education trains our loves, forms our habits, and in that way embeds in us a particular vision of the good life. So this education that Smith is talking about obviously goes on beyond the bounds of a school. We're everywhere in our lives immersed in formative practices that shape our identities and make us into particular kinds of people who aim our love at different ends. So this is why Smith is interested in what he calls cultural liturgies. These are formative practices at work in our contemporary culture that embed in us those visions of the good life. So today I just want to look at three cultural liturgies that are at work in our contemporary culture: freedom, utility, and therapy. These are three lesser gods that demand our worship today. And along the way, I hope to demonstrate ways of reading the world and reading the word in light of our reading of the world. So when it comes to reading the world, the sorts of questions that I guess my three explorations have been guided by are as follows. What are we trained to love, to aspire to worship? What are the holy grails that we are pursuing? What kinds of attitudes and behaviours are nurtured in us through our everyday experiences, and what kind of people do they make us out to be? What vision of the world does a particular cultural liturgy promote, and how does it understand the good life? Alongside that, we've got reading the word. What's the fallout, however, of this vision of the good life promoted by this cultural liturgy? If idols ultimately break the hearts of their worshippers, then how does this good life deform us? And how can the story of what God has done for us in Jesus Christ be brought to bear on these rites of contemporary worship? It's important to be able to understand and account for the force of the cultural liturgies that we're immersed in, because realistically, all of us are going to be serving something, and the students also in your care, they will too. So we need to know what it is we worship and why. So let's look at the first one, freedom.
Are you among the restless many? Each tick of the old clock, a reminder that stillness is what actually kills us. When the walls close in, do you climb out? When the road ends, do you go on? Restlessness starts with an itch and ends in progress. It is your ambition refusing to be bottled up, begging for a little blue sky time. Genetics have a voice you can only deny so long. They scream, go, run, act, find, dare. Where you go when you have the itch is free will. How you get there is why we made the new Cherokee.
I'm glad you're laughing. Okay, like most car ads, this was the ad for Jeep Cherokee for the last year's Super Bowl. And like most car ads, this Jeep Cherokee links the car with freedom, right? The freedom to go where you want, when you want, and with whomever you want. And really, the ad just hits all the beats, right? There's images of endless highways, the joy of movement as opposed to the stagnation of, you know, being still, friends on adventures together in secluded wilderness settings, people throwing back their heads in joy and laughter, exulting in the world and its possibilities. And its vision of the good life, we might say, is one in which the individual is free from restraint. There's no rules, just possibility, adventure, and the open road. This is actually a vision of unrestrained freedom, and one that particularly captivates because I suppose we feel so hemmed in by our everyday experiences, and perhaps most of our experiences driving are going to be experiences of being hemmed in. You know, we've got road rules, seat belts, pedestrians, traffic, everything like that, okay? But the Jeep, if the ad makers are doing their job right, is actually associated with adventure, daring, being unlimited, getting away from it all, being active rather than passive, you know, go, run, act, find, dare. So the Jeep baptizes the desire to satisfy your wanderlust. It's your ticket to freedom. So as I said, this ad operates with a negative conception of freedom, where freedom is defined as freedom from constraint, freedom from social regulation, from restriction, from authority. Now, ads like this present a quite innocuous version of freedom, of negative freedom. It, you know, it's not exactly subversive to sort of run through the field with your arms kind of outstretched. But I guess if we could say that if the seed is present in the flower, then perhaps the extreme articulation of the view of negative freedom is present even in the tamer versions of it. Os Guinness puts it this way. Freedom from constraint will press instinctively for freedom from all outside constraints, whether from social conventions, long-standing traditions, rational criteria, moral standards, or divine commandments, for they are all external constraints that hamper freedom so defined. Yep. And he goes on to say, unrestrained freedom is disordered and deranged. Worse, it's nihilistic, in that there is absolutely nothing on the horizon, above, behind, or around, to command the chooser's obedience or hamper the chooser's will. So this kind of freedom promotes a very libertarian notion of freedom that equates freedom with choice. To be free is to have options to choose and to be able to choose uncoerced and unconstrained among those options. Which means that this libertarian freedom basically consists of the freedom to determine one's own good. So John Stuart Mill said, over himself, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. So a consequence of that is that the only freedom which deserves the name is that of pursuing our own good in our own way. So basically, no one else can tell me how to live, not God, religion, tradition, culture, or any other source of authority. I will determine my ultimate end for myself. There's no telos or ultimate end towards which my choices should be directed, for any specified telos I haven't chosen for myself actually imposes on my freedom. And we got a sense of that in the ad. It said, where you go when you have the itch is free will. How you get there is why we made the new Cherokee. So it doesn't specify where you go, right? Because this is up to you to determine. We just want you to, you know, ride Cherokee while you're doing it. So we could observe that for negative freedom, choice itself, rather than the content of any choice, has become the heart of freedom. The result is that modern people value choice rather than good choice. That's a quote from Guinness. Os Guinness. Now, that negative freedom is tantamount to this proliferation of choices without any sort of valuation between them, is evident in a clip from Thank You for Smoking. Has anyone seen this film? A couple people have. So Nick, played by Aaron Eckhart, is a lobbyist for Big Tobacco. And in this scene, he's showing his son Joey how to manipulate an argument to your own advantage. And obviously this is what Nick does every day in advocating on behalf of the tobacco industry. But Joey, as before this scene kicks off, Joey's asking his dad, what if you're arguing for is ultimately wrong? Okay.
So, what happens when you're wrong?
Oh, Joey, I'm never wrong.
But you can't always be right.
Well, if it's your job to be right, then you're never wrong.
But what if you are wrong?
Okay, let's say that you're defending chocolate, and I'm defending vanilla. Now, If I were to say to you, vanilla is the best flavor ice cream, you'd say...
No, chocolate is.
Exactly. But you can't win that argument. So, I'll ask you. So you think chocolate is the end-all and be-all of ice cream, do you?
It's the best ice cream. I wouldn't order any of it.
Oh, so it's all chocolate for you, is it?
Yes, chocolate is all I need.
Well, I need more than chocolate. And for that matter, I need more than vanilla. I believe that we need freedom and choice when it comes to our ice cream. And that, Joy Naylor, that is the definition of liberty.
But that's not what we're talking about.
Ah, but that's what I'm talking about.
But you didn't prove that vanilla is the best.
I didn't have to. I proved that you're wrong. And if you're wrong, I'm right.
But you still didn't convince me.
It's that I'm not after you. I'm after them.
Okay, so rather than engage the actual argument, which is better, chocolate or vanilla, Nick actually just wins the argument by distracting with an appeal to freedom. He's actually indifferent, we might say, to chocolate or vanilla, smoking or not smoking, but he implies that the freedom to choose between the two is what ultimately matters. Now, of course, chocolate versus vanilla is a harmless choice, I think we might agree. So it's not a great comparison between smoking and not smoking. Or maybe in Nick's mind, it's actually the perfect comparison since he's committed to not valuing the different options on offer. He's just valuing people's right to decide between them. Now, if modern people value choice rather than good choice, then it's no surprise that our lives today are dominated by two instruments that are all about facilitating individual choice up to a point, we might say. The free market and the internet. So Michael Sandel says that the market doesn't wag fingers. And so if everything is a matter of buying and selling, then it actually doesn't matter what you buy and sell. So things that we would normally think lie beyond the market, love, humans, human organs, etc., these actually become up for grabs. That's the free market. What about the internet? Well, Emily Witt, again, let's hear from her. She says, "The friendly blandness of Google's interface bestowed blessings on the words that passed through its sieve. On Google, all words were created equal, as all ways of choosing to life one... Sorry. On Google, all words were created equal, as all ways of choosing to live one's life were equal. Google blurred the distinction between normal and abnormal. The answers its algorithms harvested assured each person of the presence of the like-minded. No one need be alone with her aberrant desires, and no desires were aberrant." It's really an essay to read rather than read out loud. But she's basically saying, on Google, all perversions are created equal. You can type whatever you want into Google's interface, and within reason, you know, whatever you desire will be served up to you. Now, if we enthrone choice as our first good, then we have to remain indifferent to the choices that are available. And we also effectively wash our hands of responsibility for others who are also faced with the same choices. So let's hear from Guinness again. He says, "What begins as freedom from interference, that negative freedom, easily slides into the freedom of indifference. I'm happy to be left to myself, so why should I care about others? Thus, emancipation from the constraints of others quickly becomes an evasion of concern for others. I don't care what you do becomes what happens to you is no business of mine, so that no one is their brother's keeper." So we might observe that negative freedom is characterised by a profound indifference. Firstly, that's an indifference to the various choices on offer. Smoking versus not smoking may as well be chocolate versus vanilla. Plus, Guinness's freedom of indifference. I am not my brother's keeper. I'll look after myself, you look after you, all good. Now, the combination of these two types of indifference that characterise negative freedom means that we must remain indifferent to the story that Emily Witt is ultimately telling, okay, of a 23-year-old woman, not herself, but a 23-year-old woman who consents to public sexual humiliation willingly, right? And this is that seedy sexual underbelly of San Francisco that Emily Witt is documenting. Now, it's emphasised throughout what goes on that the woman is there freely, willingly, consciously. You know, recalling the Jeep ad, where you go when you have the itch is free will. You might even say that by engaging in these acts, this woman feels a particular kind of itch and her free will is the means to scratch it. Now, in fact, what me calling what goes on her public sexual humiliation, you know, may not be accurate. If we follow negative freedom and its glorification of individual choice down the path that it leads us, we have nothing to say about what this woman is doing except that she consented. It's okay. But Rod Dreher articulates the position we're then left in. If you choose hell, we will call it heaven because it's freely chosen. Now, obviously, this is a really extreme example of freedom, but it summarises the indifference that is demanded of us by negative freedom. If we have no reigning conception of the good, then this woman's choice to engage in public sex or not engage in public sex is that chocolate versus vanilla decision. You know, one or the other, all good. And this example is also a logical extension of negative freedom, since it proclaims that I am free from all conceptions of the good that I do not choose for myself. Now, one of the problems with this articulation of negative freedom, and there are many, is that it has no reply to the charge that refusing all checks on our desires, except for the ones that we choose for ourselves, can actually see us being mastered by our own weaknesses. And this is the paradox at the heart of freedom, that even freedom can make you a slave. And this actually is acknowledged at some point in Emily Witt's essay. She talks about how people, her friends, clam up whenever the subject of pornography is mentioned. Far from being an instrument of sexual liberation, they all feel so oppressed by their need for it. And they even long, they are quite nostalgic for the days when pornography was nothing more than, you know, like scantily clad women lying by the pool, right? It's obviously gone much further along than that today. It's kind of the paradox that faces Brandon in the film Shame, a film about sex addiction. But the film producer, Ian Canning, actually says that the film is a bit of a parable on freedom. Ian Canning said that the film Shame is a story of a man who has every freedom and yet uses his body to create his own prison. Brandon, of course, is actually a more benign version of Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Both Brandon and Patrick enjoy the good life, right? They're handsome, they're successful, well off. They live lives of unparalleled freedom. But they each tell a story of spiritual emptiness, even in the midst of material abundance. That's American Psycho, and you might say sexual abundance in Shame. This is what Bret Easton Ellis had to say, the author of American Psycho. On the surface, like Patrick Bateman, I had everything a young man could possibly want to be happy, and yet I wasn't. Patrick Bateman is the extreme embodiment of that dissatisfaction. Nothing fulfills him. The more he acquires, the emptier he feels. On a certain level, I was that man too. I should mention that the examples in this section are quite R-rated. The rest of the presentation and the seminar is not like that at all. Okay? Now, articulating freedom as endless indifferent choice in which only I can determine my own good is obviously not the answer, right? Good choice matters, and we need to recover good choices as the heart of freedom. If negative freedom is freedom from constraint, then, you know, what's positive freedom? Freedom for the good. As David Bentley Hart says, we are free not merely because we can choose, but only when we have chosen well. And this challenges negative freedom's fundamental indifference to the available choices. Because if we're created, then living and choosing in line with our created natures is what it means to live well, is what it means to choose well. We're not autonomous beings who get to determine our own good for ourselves. Now, we opened with the Jeep Cherokee ad, and you might find it interesting that this idea that freedom, real freedom, is less about choosing than it is about choosing well, is evident even in this ad. Because beneath the stirring adventures of adventure, getting off the beaten track, breaking free of the mundane, were these tiny little public service style announcements that provided the reality check to these fantasies of unlimited freedom. Okay, if you were beyond maybe the first couple of rows, you probably didn't see them, but there was an image of a guy skateboarding down a road. Down the bottom appeared, closed road. Of the guy somersaulting off the cliff and then a girl throwing a flare into the night, do not attempt. And then when we saw the Jeep traversing over this rough terrain, professional driver on closed course. So if we kind of like catalogue the various, you know, verbal phrases that we see throughout the ad, we get closed road, do not attempt, professional driver on closed course, built free, right? So you might say, is this public messaging, public service messaging, at odds with the ad, you know, what the ad's trying to convey. The ad's saying, you know, get out there, do whatever you like. This says, can't do that. Well, it's one way to look at it, that the messaging is at odds with the ad's fundamental message. But another way to look at it is that maybe it's an acknowledgement, right, that unlimited freedom is a fiction. It may be fun to fantasize about, but the reality is that making good choices is more important than having the freedom to choose. And if that's the case, then maybe we have an opportunity here to challenge the common assumption that rules or laws, whether we're talking about, you know, those instituted by God, authorities, government, or anything else, the common assumption is that these rules are often arbitrary and meaningless, and they're designed to oppress us, to kind of keep us down for the sake of keeping us down. But Jesus, of course, declares that he's come that we might have life and life to the full. And he reframes, therefore, God's laws and the way that we're called to live, not as restrictive, but as protective, and what will actually produce our good. These laws, then, aren't an imposition, but they're actually the condition for any kind of freedom. Smith puts it this way: the biblical vision of human flourishing is that we are only properly free when our desires are rightly ordered, when they are bounded and directed to the end that constitutes our good. So positive freedom, then, is freedom to choose well in light of the human good that we do not determine for ourselves, but only receive as the gift of God. But positive freedom, however, isn't just the freedom to choose well. It's also the freedom freedom for the good of others. And this articulation of positive freedom responds to that freedom of indifference that's demanded by negative freedom, this idea that I'm only responsible to myself and for myself. If you look at Corinthians, I have the right to do anything you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do everything, but not everything is constructive. Paul says, no one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Don't cause anyone to stumble. I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that many may be saved. So this is how I suppose we can show the promise of a Christian community, that sure, we have the right to choose, but we choose with other people's good in mind. We are our brother's keeper. Because obviously in Paul's words, I'm not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved, we hear an echo of Jesus, who didn't, again, seek his own good, but the good of all for salvation. So that's freedom. Let's talk about utility. Okay, so trashing millennials is kind of a popular sport. I don't know if you've noticed. A Time magazine cover in 2013 branded them the me generation, calling them lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with their parents. Young people are also accused of being too comfortably bourgeois, privileged but incurious about the deeper meaning of life. Others have said that they are not rebellious enough. David Brooks has said that young people tend to be morally stunted, uninterested in developing their character or inner virtue. So the picture being painted here is that young people today are achievement-oriented, more interested in career and earning power than in developing a meaningful philosophy of life. Now, Fareed Zakaria wrote an article in response to these criticisms for The Atlantic, and he basically said, if young people are like this today, can you blame them? He says, young people are merely responding to market conditions of uncertainty, flexibility and incredible competition for places and in college and jobs. Young people, he says, can't rely on the whole one job for life model as previous generations could. Loyalty isn't what it used to be on the part of both employers and employees, so people need to position themselves well, get the skills they need, be prepared to move on when a better opportunity arises. So people may need to change careers over the course of a lifetime several times. So, you know, it's good, right, that young people are entrepreneurial as a result. So he's basically saying, essentially, young people are mirroring the values of the world they've inherited, and which tells them that in order to be successful, you've got to have a competitive edge, you've got to be useful, you've got to be self-sufficient and in demand. Now, this is very much an American story, but no doubt it's broadly applicable in Australia as well, especially when you hear Joe Hockey say that the solution to being able to afford a house is to get a higher paying job, right? So it's not hard to imagine that Australian young people are also being groomed, essentially, to become as career-minded and achievement-oriented as their American counterparts. David Brooks also makes the observation that I think would be applicable in Australia as well as America. He says that Western culture and its institutions, particularly its educational institutions, spend more time developing what he calls our resume virtues, the skills that we bring to the marketplace, rather than our eulogy virtues, the ones that are worth eulogising. You know, whether we're kind, brave, honest, faithful. So in other words, he says, our culture cares more about career success than it does about character. But there is a price to be paid. In spending our formative years focusing on achievement, running on the test-taking treadmill, getting that scholarship, internship, that job, becoming partner, and doing what we can to get ahead in the world, we're also being trained up day in and day out to link our worth as people to the contribution that we're making. That's a cultural liturgy that is so dominant today. So in doing so, we reveal that the holy grail we're chasing is being valued or being useful. Now, we could have focused on a related vision of the good life, the idea of material wealth, abundance of worldly possessions or expensive experiences like overseas holidays, etc. But I think usefulness kind of sits behind those even, because our ability to acquire those conventional trappings of success, house, car, holiday, etc., testifies to how valued we are in the eyes of the world because we can be paid for it. So the lesser God that we worship in this case isn't necessarily material riches, but it's utility. Now, in Vulnerable Communion, Thomas Reynolds explores the way the category of disability is constructed by what he calls the cult of normalcy. And this is a set of practices and values about what constitutes the normal body that therefore assigns a lower worth, or what he calls body capital, to people whose bodies fail to live up to the ideal. So the cult of normalcy actually explicitly ties an individual's value to their usefulness. And it does that through a cluster of values that Reynolds calls the productive imperative. This is the obligation for people to be useful, right? And in a market society, this is indelibly bound up with their ability to both generate and consume capital. Now, Reynolds' particular interest is in the way that the cult of normalcy excludes or marginalises people with disabilities. But the reality is the productive imperative subjects everyone, disabled or not, to the same performance standards. So what are these standards? You satisfy the productive imperative if you can earn money, right? If you are efficient in the way that you earn the money. If you are oriented toward the new and the novel, if you're entrepreneurial, meaning that you can adapt to new market conditions and stay competitive. And lastly, you satisfy the productive imperative if you can spend money, because this, of course, keeps the machine going, right? So you're productive if you earn money, are efficient, oriented towards the new, and if you can spend money. So we can add some more detail to the good life that we've already established in this case. Not only does it involve being highly valued for being useful, but in a market society, this also means having earning power and buying power. And that will confirm you as a useful, contributing member of society. You know, a lifter instead of a leaner in the government's rhetoric. Now, this ultimately all boils down to the idea that one's success or one's failure is intimately linked to what one does. Now, the problem with this view is that, well, everyone must be useful. There's no place for dependence. It's by default humiliating and undesirable. Another problem, those who can't satisfy the productive imperative are immediately consigned to a lower worth and value, right? Those with disabilities, they're very young. You can't see them earning money necessarily if they're 2 years old, or maybe in some countries. They're very old at the other end of the spectrum. What about unpaid carers? Their work is not valued. And those who, for whatever reason, just can't satisfy market demands of usefulness of productivity. So it excludes a heck of a lot of people. Now, all of us at one point or another, and this is the last problem that I want to outline, all of us are going to fall short, basically, of these unforgiving standards that apply to everyone at some stage. Our daily immersion in these formative rituals that consistently link our worth as individuals to our achievements drills into us this conviction that one needs to be useful and, you know, read, generate and commute and consume capital in order to be a contributing member of society. And this leaves us in absolutely no position to cope with life experiences that are probably going to happen to us sooner or later. which directly challenge our culture's measures of success and usefulness. Illness, disability, being a stay-at-home parent, needing to slow down or become like a full-time carer. You might even say that our devotion to this lesser god of utility surely explains why people want euthanasia legalized. We often hear it said, I don't want to be a burden. Okay, what they're essentially saying is, I'm now a leaner rather than a lifter, and I don't like that. When people are a burden, they can no longer contribute usefully, and they're actually draining resources. And this language of burden reveals the dominance of market thinking and the way that we think about each other and the way that we think about ourselves, because we've so deeply internalized that need to be useful. And of course, you know, people do request euthanasia on the grounds of autonomy, but I want to raise questions whether it can really be an autonomous choice in a society that so values productivity and usefulness. Now, Thomas Reynolds asserts that the basic question of human existence is whether there is welcome at the heart of things. Will I be received and embraced? Is there a voice behind all other voices that says, you are precious and I will be there for you? Now, if we devote ourselves to the lesser god of utility, then the answer is no, there is not welcome at the heart of things. But if we are to say yes, and I think God is pushing us to say yes, welcome is at the heart of things, we will have to take up Elizabeth McKinlay's challenge. She's an Anglican priest, a professor in the School of Theology at Charles Sturt University, and also a specialist in aged care, disability, and spirituality. The challenge is, she says, to revalue life so that being is valued as much as doing. I think this is one of the most radical statements you might ever hear in your life, living in the world that we do. To revalue life so that being is valued as much as doing. And if you're anything like me, this is very confronting to hear. You know, being what? Isn't being about doing? Who am I apart from what I do? But the Christian doctrine of the image of God, that everyone is made in his image, guarantees the dignity and worth of everyone, regardless of capacity. We know that the image of God is not reducible to function or ability. You know, it's not about how much rationality we have, because this rules out, you know, newborns and people with dementia. It's not about moral awareness or the particular capability. Right. I mean, if it did, then as a sleep-deprived parent, I probably wouldn't qualify for rationality. But if we are the same person from the beginning of life to the end of life, and ethicists call this ontological continuity, which basically means a continuity of being from beginning to end, if we're the same person right from the beginning of life till the end, we actually need a grounding of dignity that remains constant despite all the change that we experience in our lives. And that's exactly found in the Imago Dei. It enables us to value being as much as doing, and it's necessary if we're to secure the personhood from for people with dementia, for example, from whom all personhood seems to be stripped away. The image of God's status of everyone is the only guarantee that welcome underwrites reality. For it proclaims that, as Reynolds says, what matters most is whose we are, not what we are, measured in terms of values fostered by human economies of exchange. Real value is based in God's unconditional affirmation of human beings. It's the divine gift of grace that is fundamental. And this image of God thing, that's what Christianity has. And it has it in a very positive way, as opposed to every other ideology or religion that's on offer. Okay, therapy. Has anyone read We Need to Talk About Kevin? Or seen the film? I haven't done either, but I hear that it involves a child who has committed a Columbine High School massacre style event, and this woman, the mother, needs to sort of live with the consequences of what her son has done. It was written by Lionel Shriver. Okay, so Lionel Shriver could have afforded children, she writes in a new book of collected essays on why people choose not to have children. So she could have afforded children, but she just didn't want them, she says. They would have siphoned away too much time from my precious books. Selfish, you know? Perhaps. But she locates her feelings on this matter in the context of what she calls a larger transformation in Western culture, no less profound than our collective consensus on what life is for. She writes, "As we age, we're apt to look back on our pasts and question, not did I serve family, God and country, but did I ever get to Cuba or run a marathon? Did I take up landscape painting? Was I fat?" We will assess the success of our lives in accordance not with whether they were righteous, but whether they were interesting and fun. I'm just going to read that last bit again because I think it's really important. We will assess the success of our lives in accordance not with whether they were righteous, but whether they were interesting and fun. So she's basically tracking the shift away from living for a possibly celestial future, the afterlife, to actually enjoying the here and now. She calls it the be here now mentality. Possibly, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the students that you're teaching would call this the YOLO approach to life, right? You only live once, so have your best shot at it. This YOLO approach to life, this be here now mentality, summarizes what Philip Reeve called the triumph of the therapeutic, where the goal of life is self-realization and self-fulfillment through well-being. In our time, Philip Reeve says, therapy has replaced religion. Self-realization has replaced salvation. Psychological man has replaced religious man. We've thrown off the religious constraints of old in order to find myself. So religious man, just a quick summary of the two. Religious man was committed to communal purpose, a sense of overarching meaning that grounded the self and in which alone the self could be realized and satisfied. Religious man was also subject to these moralizing demands that, for the good of the community, instituted various restraints, the thou shalt nots, but also compensated for these restraints through various permissions. Okay, so there's this delicate dance of permissions and prohibitions, let's say, that religious man was subject to. And I guess to frame it as a thou shalt not sounds really repressive, but for Reeve, such prohibitions are actually positive because they're about self-mastery and self-discipline. They're about acquired skills that liberate us from the other impulses that we perhaps shouldn't be driven by. That's religious man. Psychological man, though, is the supreme individualist who's been set free from communal purpose, but not just communal purpose, but tradition and authority. Whereas before, religious man surrounded himself and was understood meaning in the context of a larger whole, the new centre of self for psychological man is the self. Where religious man understands impulse control, psychological man is about impulse release. So in the therapeutic age, satisfaction and contentment supplant the once widespread logics of restraint, sacrifice and punishment that would have made sense to religious man. Now, it's perhaps so 5 years ago to talk about Oprah, but her catch cry that's promoted through her media empire, "Live your best life," sums up the philosophy of psychological man. So the holy grail we're pursuing in this case is the fully realized self, the one who doesn't go along with the crowd, but who remains true to their inner sense of who they are, who follows the dictates of their conscience, who's able to express themselves fully. You can see this, you know, going on in the Jeep ad that we watched earlier. And this sentiment, live your best life, is often found in our culture. You know, we often hear, find yourself, be true to yourself, do your own thing, be yourself, express yourself, follow your bliss. But if these are a little bit too pop psychology for you, then there's also words like authenticity and being authentic, right? I want to be authentic. This obviously has roots in the romantic expressivism of the late 19th century. And Charles Taylor sort of explains the mindset here. This kind of thinking of romantic expressivism holds that each one of us has his or her own way of realizing our humanity, and that it's important to find and live out one's own as against surrendering to conformity with a model imposed on us from outside, whether by society or previous generation or religious or political authority. So we pursue this holy grail because we think that self-realization is the path to happier, more fulfilled lives. Now, in ages past, morality was concerned with how to live, right? What should and should not be done. But in the therapeutic age, morality is about heeding one's own truth and living well. As Hervé Jouvin says, the duty of well-being is becoming our morality. He goes on, "We're here on earth to have a good time. not to perform dazzling acts or aspire to heroism, not to occupy the place assigned to us by a higher order, not even to accumulate and pass on, just get the most we can out of it. There is little idea of the abrupt abandonment in less than two generations of the world of dues and bonds for the world of the self and rights. From Religious Man to Psychological Man. The real revolution is the one that has given everyone a taste of the privilege enjoyed by yesterday's aristocrat, his own pleasure and nothing more. Now, the therapeutic quest for self-realization and self-fulfillment represents a secularization, you might say, of religion. We've done away with God and made gods of our own selves. And where religion might once have held out the promise of heaven as consolation for, you know, the misery, perhaps, of earthly existence, the therapeutic age gets us to train our gaze on this life first and foremost. We've got that obliteration of that vertical orientation for the horizontal, to continue that theme from Marx's talk earlier. Now, this therapeutic quest seems to rely on a functional atheism, a world stripped of God and the transcendent. Because if there's no God, no gods, no afterlife, then no one's coming to get us and no heaven to look forward to. So it's up to us to live long and live as well as possible. You know, you only live once. In this context, the question of how to live well, how to be happy, becomes very important. Especially because we only have one shot at life. In fact, this was the theme of the recent Sydney Writers' Festival, How to Live Well. Sorry, I'm so out of practice speaking. So this, How to Live Well, was the theme of the recent Sydney Writers' Festival. It was explored in a panel featuring Douglas Copeland, who wrote Generation X, Paul Dolan from the London School of Economics, and his book, Happiness by Design, Hugh McKay, social commentator, and his book is The Art of Belonging, Leanne Hennion, her book is phenomenal, A Hesitant Adventurer's Search for Wonder in the Natural World, and Anne Mann, a social commentator, and her book is The Life of I, The New Culture of Narcissism. So we've got like an author, an economist perhaps, or a philosopher, social commentator, a hippie, and another social commentator, okay? Now, there was consensus on this diverse panel of people that Western culture had taken a wrong turn somewhere, that maybe it was capitalism or maybe it was technology. These two things had sort of set us on this path, and it was difficult to kind of go back on that path. And when discussion turned to the matter of happiness in this context, Leanne Hennion advanced her particular philosophy, right, which is a very familiar therapeutic statement. Live the life, she says, that no one else can live. Just to give you some context, so Leanne Hennion had a baby. She's a travel writer, and she had a baby, and the experience of motherhood for the first time traumatized her. You know, we're talking like post-traumatic stress, postnatal depression, etc. And she was so horrified by this idea that she would never be free from this child, even though she loved him so deeply, that she thought back to when she was last happy and connected and vibrant, etc. And she recalled seeing those crazy big butterflies in South America or something. So from that experience and that memory of fulfillment and nostalgia, she then wrote a bucket list of experiences of the natural world that she thought would bring her back to herself. Okay, and so you know, she wanted to see the volcanic eruption in Hawaii, the northern lights in Sweden, the great migration of Tanzania. She even came to Australia to watch a total solar eclipse. And she completed all these elements on her travel bucket list in week-long bursts before her son was two. So she left her son with her husband and all her parents, and she went away for week-long trips. So she says, live the life that no one else can live. Now, others on the panel strongly disagreed with her that this was the route to happiness and fulfillment. Hugh McKay said, go off and have your adventures, be refreshed, etc. But, you know, meaning is found by coming back and building good relationships where you are. Anne Mann, whose book is on narcissism, and she looks at people like Lance Armstrong, but also Anders Breivik, right, who committed that mass murder. She says mass murders like Anders Breivik could also be said to be following that philosophy, living the life that no one else could live. Whereas, she said, the woman who cares for her mother with early onset Alzheimer's, you know, she may not be living a flash life, but certainly she's living a good one. So both Hugh McKay and Anne Mann were pointing to the importance of care, its costliness, yes, but also how much it enriched life. So, you know, set alongside that, both Leanne Hennion's and Lionel Shriver's philosophy, to an extent, emerge from this understanding of care of the self is to superintend all other care, right? That's a very therapeutic understanding, that self-care matters more, or at least needs to be put in a higher position than the care of others, particularly because children, you know, demand so much from us and they too severely curtail autonomy. Now, what do we do with this, right? I actually find it really encouraging. You've got Leanne Hennion and Lionel Shriver preaching self-realization, a self that's true to itself and its needs above all else. But you've also got Hugh McKay and Anne Mann, who are not Christians, I might add, slapping all this down as self-absorption. They're saying that a good life, the route to happiness and fulfillment, is found in relationships. So they themselves see deep problems with this therapeutic outlook, which has so dominated Western culture over the last little while. And perhaps this is why Charles Taylor is more positively inclined towards the age of authenticity than Philip Reeve or Hervé Jouvin. Those critics would say that authenticity and self-realization is basically hedonistic and self-absorbed. But Taylor says that such criticisms are just too sweeping, right? He says the quest for authenticity may begin as a fundamentally egotistical endeavor, but it can end up in someone coming to faith in God in the traditional sense. Now, Anne Mann and Hugh McKay, as I said, they aren't Christians in any traditional way, not that I know, but both are interested in authenticity in as much as it involves a negotiation between the needs of others and the needs of the self. And their intuitions on this point absolutely resonate with Christian ideas about the importance of relationships, costly as they are. Now, earlier in the same panel, Hugh McKay had said that we do know how to be happy. We know how to be happy. We know that the route to happiness is living for other people. But he also said, but even though we know this, we don't do this. There's a failure of will somewhere, which I found really interesting coming from Hugh McKay because, you know, Christians understand what that is. That's called sin, right? We know what's good for us, but for some reason we can't or we won't follow through with it. Now, sin wasn't talked about in any sort of religious way on the panel. That's just my spin on it. But regardless, this fundamental failure of will, which they called their version of sin, that was identified by this panel, points to the problem with pursuing the holy grail of a fully realized self, of following our bliss. Will being true to ourselves ultimately make us happy? What if we're selfish jerks? What if we have impulses that are better off restrained than indulged? Perhaps rather than being true to ourselves, we'd be better off being honest with ourselves. So I'm encouraged because at the very least, we've got opportunities to try and start a conversation about Christianity and the therapeutic ethos by picking up on those points of agreement between that have been identified by Anne Mann and Hugh McKay. You know, belief in the importance of relationships, the acknowledgement that even if we know living for others is the route to happiness, we still don't do this, that also being true to ourselves allows impulses to run riot that perhaps it would be better off to restrain. And to these we can also add that sense of positive freedom that I spoke about earlier, the freedom to choose for other people's good and not simply my own. Now, the therapeutic age is, above all, interested in being yourself, finding yourself as the means of fulfillment. Jesus, however, makes the tantalizing claim that counter to all the therapeutic wisdom in the world today, losing one's life for his sake is actually the means to find it. Now, we tend to think God's gain equals my loss. We tend to think others' gain is my loss. And it's not helped by the fact that Christians often preach other person-centeredness to the point of self-annihilation. I think I've been guilty of that sometimes, right? We preach other person-centeredness to the point of self-annihilation. But as John Stackhouse says, fundamental to Christian life is shalom, an all-embracing life of mutual contribution and benefit. He says, fundamental to Christian life is what I call the principle of win-win-win. Within the life circle of shalom, Individuals and groups are never finally in a situation of choosing whether to benefit themselves or others, never finally in a situation of choosing to honour God over their own well-being. So basically it's win-win-win. When you win, I win, and God wins. For God's joy is bound up with our joy. Some will say, and they would be right, to God be the glory, but this doesn't mean that I must diminish as a result. Because Irenaeus says, the glory of God is a woman fully alive. He doesn't say woman, but I'm just saying that here today. The glory of God is a woman fully alive. The glory of God is a man fully alive. That's the glory of God. So perhaps in seeking the individual's fulfillment above all else and being unencumbered by anyone else in the therapeutic age, C.S. Lewis's wisdom applies today as it did, you know, when he wrote it. Maybe our desires are not too strong, but actually too weak. Maybe in seeking merely our own fulfillment, this is actually a very weak desire. Far stronger is it to seek the win-win-win of God's abundant economy. Some final words. We find ourselves drawn to lesser gods. But if, as Augustine says, we've been made for God, our hearts will be restless until they rest in him. Nothing less than God will satisfy. Devoting ourselves to lesser gods, romantic love in the case of Emily Witt, unrestrained freedom, utility and self-realization that we've talked about today, this will ultimately break our hearts if we devote ourselves to these gods. In fact, this is actually what happens to Emily Witt. By the end of her journey, she writes, when your life doesn't conform to an idea and this failure makes you feel bad, throwing away the idea can make you feel better. At the time I read this, I actually felt incredibly sad for her, even though I know that she was chasing a delusion, right? But her loss of faith in that messiah of romantic love was quite crushing, particularly as it's like she descended into the bowels of, you know, hell in order to come to this conclusion. But perhaps being disillusioned with the lesser gods that she's given herself over to, maybe it's worth the heartbreak, because the possibility remains then that she can still discover the God of Jesus Christ. That's my hope. Thank you.
Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.